in me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Don't want to confuse you, but if you're a regular, you know I like to insert some thematic music whenever I can. And what better day to do that than on Earth Day? That, of course, was the incomparable Marvin Gaye singing Mercy, Mercy Me, the ecology song. And that's kind of the theme of Earth Day. So the first federally designated Earth Day was 40 years ago. And the events that day occurred largely on college campuses, where there were rallies and lectures, consciousness-raising programs to get folks involved. And that was then, and this is now. Joining me today, Earth Day 2010, to talk about how things change or maybe how they stay the same, is Tad Dritz. He's credited with founding the modern Earth Day movement in Columbus just a few years ago, and the nonprofit Green Columbus was born after that. He hoped to enlist some 10,000 volunteers last weekend to help at cleanups in 150 sites around town. We'll find out more about that later. Tad, welcome to the show.
And thanks for having me on. 10,000 was our goal. We didn't quite reach it, but we did have a fantastic volunteer turnout this past weekend.
Well, you got to have goals, right?
Right.
Yeah.
We like stretch goals, too.
Jed Thorpe, he is Public Involvement Coordinator for the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency. Jed has worked on a variety of environmental issues for Ohio Citizen Action, Clean Water Action in Boston, and the Sierra Club in Columbus. He was an AmeriCorps volunteer in 2002 and also serves on the board of directors for the Buckeye Forest Council in Green Columbus. Sounds like a radical from 40 years ago, Jed. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
It's not so radical anymore, though, is it?
No, it's become a more mainstream now.
Right. Finally, Buckeye Forest Council Interim Executive Director, Cheryl Johncox. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. I'm really happy to be here today.
Let's see. The Buckeye Forest Council was founded in 1992, well after Earth Day 1970.
Yeah, but in keeping with the theme of Earth Day, we were founded by a student organization, the Student Environmental Action Coalition from Ohio State University. So that I think that student action continues well through today, as you can see on college campuses across the nation and right here in Ohio, as they really step up to the call to do something about climate change and other important environmental issues.
You know, I'm going to ask each of my guests what sparked their environmental heartbeat and when and where. And I'm asking that of our listeners today. What if you're an environmentalist, if you consider yourself an environmentalist, if you believe in Earth Day and all that it represents, call and let us know what it was. What sparked that interest in you? How old were you? What was it? Was it the crying Indian by the Ad Council and I think Keep America Beautiful back in the 70s? Or was it the Give a Hoot, Don't Pollute also in the 70s? Or was it just something completely recent and probably something I haven't even heard of yet? Let us know, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Earth Day's for everybody, so I hope you'll participate. And then I'll tell you what sparked it in me. You know, in a story in the other paper in March, it said that when you moved here in 2002, Tad, you had the impression that Central Ohio's activists weren't terribly active when it came to the environment. And I thought, well, how bad could that have been? But it turns out that there really was no organized Earth Day events at that point?
There was not. Since 1994, I think there was kind of a gulf between 1994
and 2007
that there was no kind of citywide, region-wide Earth Day event. There was three things going on for Earth Day in 2006. One was Green Drinks, is what I organized with some other compatriots. There was an event at the Wetlands Restoration Project at OSU. There was like a cleanup day there. And then there was also a small rally on OSU campus. Altogether, that attracted about 150 people. The next year when we organized Earth Day, when we kind of reconstituted it here in Columbus, Ohio, we had 1,300 volunteers come out to work at volunteer work sites and about 5,000 people come through Goodale Park, our celebration.
What when was the environmental activist spark in you lit? When did that happen?
That happened back in the 90s for me. I had always really loved being in the outdoors, hiking, mountain biking, just doing all sorts of things. My father lived out in California when I was growing up, and he would always take us camping, and we did a whole bunch of things in the outdoors. I never really understood that I had some sort of role in protecting it until the 1990s. This might come as a shock to some people, but I worked in the oil industry for 6 years after I graduated from Ohio University with a chemical engineering degree. While working in Kazakhstan and in Mexico, I saw some really poor use of our natural resources, and that really sparked me to start reading books like Paul Hawkins' The Ecology of Commerce, and really set me on a path to being interested in sustainable development, is what they called it back then. Sustainability is kind of the term now. And I wanted to kind of get involved in that, and I wanted to have a role in protecting the environment. It spurred me to apply to graduate school, and I went to graduate school at the University of Michigan in a joint degree program, which was business and environmental studies.
Was it kind of new?
It was very new at the time. Yeah. So that program started in 1996, and it's still one of the leading and one of the few programs like that in the nation.
Yeah, I want to get to business and the environment in a little while. Jed, how long has there been a job like yours at the Ohio EPA?
Well, we've had some sort of communications or public outreach office, I think, probably since the agency's inception in the early 70s. Similar to Tad, I grew up camping and spending a lot of time in the outdoors. When I moved back to Ohio after graduate school, I was faced with the fact that I had to get a job doing something.
Dang it.
And I thought to myself, well, it'd be great if I could get a job working on environmental issues every day. So that's when I started looking for different employment opportunities, and I've been lucky enough to make the environment a career.
But when was that moment that you went, wait a minute, I need to get involved?
I think, you know, in the course of my thesis research, I wrote my graduate thesis on Great Lakes water pollution policy and looked at a lot of the history of the Great Lakes, and especially I'm from Northwest Ohio, grew up close to Lake Erie, and you start looking at all the things that had gone into that lake over the years, and as you become more aware, you want to become more active, and I think that's why. And, you know, environmental awareness events, environmental education outreach, like the Earth Day event that we have, is so important because when you make people aware about the problems and issues that are out there, then you can get them to take action.
You know, Cheryl, we were talking earlier about children. Mm-hmm. And I didn't grow up with any kind of sense about ecological preservation. About the environment. It just wasn't part of the lexicon back in the olden days. But it wasn't even until 1996 the University of Michigan had, and it's one of the few still that has a business and environment graduate curriculum. The Buckeye Forest Council is relatively new. Where were you? Is it maybe that you guys didn't think about yourselves as activists when you were much younger because you just took so much of it for granted growing up? There was so much more. Because, by the way, listeners, if you can't see them, but they're youthful. All three of my guests, that you grew up with it, you took it for granted, and then so it kind of the activism kind of starts at a different level.
Well, you know, I think maybe I'm not in the mainstream in that I've always been somebody that was outspoken for the environment. I was the last kid in the last farm in Strongsville, which is a suburb of Cleveland. And, you know, my family had to move from the farm when they brought in, the sewage line down the road. And we lived way back from the road. So I really saw the disappearing of the family farm, the disappearing of our forests, and the suburbia and urban sprawl was really a part of my growing up. And so I've always been very outspoken about it, and I've always had a great connection with other folks that, aren't willing to just kind of take a step back but really are out there on the cutting edge and pushing us to do, greater and better things in the environmental movement. So, I really come from this as a person that, has always been sharing their message. And I, have worked with children. I come at really from an educational perspective. I used to use nature and the environment as a way to teach kids their ABCs and their 1, 2, 3s and what their colors were, and really saw that, using basic information and basic connection with the environment and our natural way of life and our natural surroundings is a really great way to connect people. So I've really been able to use those basic things throughout my life to, you know, kind of always be pushing for better protection in the environmental movement.
What sort of education did you have as a young child? Do you remember being taught about the environment growing up? You know, in class, in science class, Ted?
There was some of that, but it certainly wasn't emphasized in a big way. And I don't remember any school that I've ever been to really making a celebration of Earth Day, that April is for something else. I don't know. I mean, certainly Easter is brought up in April, and I guess now it's testing is done,
yeah.
And
the
Ohio Achievement Test
that might have something to do with it.
Are done this week, and so it really lessens the emphasis on protecting the Earth.
But, you know, I, as an environmental educator, over the last, like, 7 years, it's really been exciting and heartening to see the amount of integration that's gone on with our sciences into the school system. And I'm a non-formal educator by trade. So I go in and I help teachers extend their programs to different areas and bring in, you know, hands-on tools in order for them to expand their curriculum and make it a little more interactive. That's my background with this. And so I'm really excited about, you know, some of the new ways that our school system and teachers teaching is opening up to connecting with nature.
I think one of the best, lectures or whatever, I'm at a loss for words unusually, and was at the Solid Waste Authority of Central Ohio when they brought a class of kids in there, and I happened to be there observing, you know, to write about it. And I learned so much in that. I don't know if you all have heard her give her spiel to the kids, but it's very educational. Of course, it's incredibly educational to actually go and see the the system and how it works and what goes on over at SWACO. They have a great educational program, though. Mm-hmm. So that's not in the schools, but the schools can avail themselves of stuff like that. Are there other things like that out there that schools could have, you know, take, you know, avail themselves of?
There's lots of things to see, I think. Dealing with solid waste, certainly. I think everybody should take a tour of the landfill. I think everybody would be shocked and surprised to find out how much stuff is thrown away every day. The landfill,
and how many cool things they're trying to do to lessen it and to make use of it.
They are trying to do some good things. And I don't want to knock SWACO, and I don't want to knock anybody who's involved in the system. But right now, it's not working here in Columbus, Ohio. Our recycling rate is about 5.7%. That's compared to 72% in San Francisco. So we have just a vast room for improvement. There was a survey done a couple of years ago of what was sent to our landfill. 60% of what was sent to our landfill could have been recycled. That means we can cut our solid waste in half or more just by recycling better. So, I mean, they do have some neat programs, and I encourage people to go look at Rumpke's single stream recovery facility and look at the landfill. But we do need to kind of rethink the problem, I think, to improve the recycling rate.
Yeah, there. One of the most shocking things I ever saw, we have to take a break in a sec, but was a big, huge semi-trailer dumping. Well, it probably was only a few pounds, but it looked like tons and tons of styrofoam into the landfill. And that really...
It's sad.
It was amazing. Yeah. I mean, the volume, and that was just one of many that would arrive that day. We have to take a short break. I want to remind my listeners, though, that our guest today, Cheryl Johncox of the Buckeye Forest Council, Tad Dritz of Green Columbus, and Jed Thorpe, he's the Public Involvement Coordinator for the Ohio EPA. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can talk about anything green that you want, but I'm particularly interested in hearing your stories about what sparked the green in you. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, healthcare reform has passed, but could premiums keep skyrocketing? A Senate plan proposes new federal regulation of insurance rates. We'll unpack the issues. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR. And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 54 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1020 this morning. Sunshine today and a high right around 68. A few clouds tonight and a low of 45. More sun for Friday, but then a few clouds in the afternoon, a high of 63.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. No, we're not talking about coal mining. We did earlier this week, but we're talking about the environment. It's Earth Day 2010, 40th anniversary of Earth Day. My guests are Tad Dritz. He's the director of Green Columbus, and also Cheryl Johncock. She's the interim executive director of the Buckeye Forest Council, and Jed Thorpe. He's the public involvement coordinator for the Ohio EPA. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, and tell us your story about what sparked your interest in the environment. Tom, you're on the air. Tell us your story. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good.
I try and recycle as much as possible. My wife and I do that, but my comment is if the government kept their promises, the fuel crisis back in the 70s where they had made car dealers, you know, get better fuel economy, if they had kept that going instead of to the wayside. Also, solar power was in its infancy. If the government had gotten behind that like they said they were going to do, just think of where we'd be at today.
Yeah, you know, is it the government or everyone always says, hey, there was no demand for it. We're a capitalist society. You know, the government can only do so much.
Well, you know, the government can only do so much. Government does a lot, whether we know it or not. But just in the fuel economy, if they had kept on top of that, you know, we would be probably having a lot better fuel-efficient cars now, you know, more, you know, mm-hmm. better than what we have now, let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, like I said, solar power, the government was involved in that in its infancy and everything, and they just dropped that off to its wayside, too. You know, everybody says the government should keep their hands out of everything. Well, you know, on certain issues, especially on national security or things that affect our nation, the government should be more involved, in my own opinion.
Okay.
Could be wrong, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All righty. Thanks, Tom.
Welcome.
Jed, you're the government.
Sure, yeah, exactly. Well, since I'm the person on the panel who works for the government, I guess I'll speak to that. You know, I think the caller has a good point that that government definitely has a role to play in not just solar power, but obviously environmental protection in general. When we talked about the first Earth Day in 1970, and when you go back to 1970 and you look at what's been accomplished over the last 40 years, you know, our environment has actually gotten a lot cleaner. The air is cleaner than it was in 1970 by most standards. The water is a lot cleaner, and that's in large part because of decisions that government made back in the early 1970s. You had the US EPA created, you had the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and back then the government was really looking at the big, major, obvious environmental problems, pollution coming out of smokestacks unchecked, communities that didn't have any sort of wastewater treatment, sewage going right into rivers. And so over the last 40 years, we've made a huge amount of progress in those real, you know, big, dangerous environmental problems in our communities. But we still have a long ways to go. And there's definitely a role for government to play in incentivizing renewable energy, solar power, wind, and so on. And I think we'll continue to look for opportunities to do that here in Ohio.
Yeah, I saw some statistics this morning. Since the 1970s, smog levels have dropped by about a quarter, which didn't seem like a lot to me, but I guess it is. And lead levels in the air are down more than 90%. And
yeah.
Burning rivers are a thing of the past, from what I understand. Yeah.
Well,
Cheryl.
You know, Ann, I think that You know, our government can only do what we ask them to do. And the reason that the EPA was set up in the 1970s and we've made so much progress because there was a grassroots cause to do that. Then during the 1980s, there was a wane in that movement because of lack of support at the grassroots level. And we see an increase in that call to do things now, largely because people, you know, Americans across the country and right here in Ohio have stood up and told the government, this is what we want for our future. This is what we want for our children. So in order to create the political will to do something, we need the support of the citizenry. We need, because there's always going to be corporations that are pushing back in order to, you know, add to their bottom lines. And I think that, you know, Ted will agree with me that, you know, really it takes me and you and all of us together to push for the things that we want.
I would imagine, Ted, that when you researched and looked back and figured out, you know, people thought we didn't need Earth Day anymore, maybe back when interest fell off. That look how much we've accomplished. What is Earth Day really about?
I don't know if, I mean, certainly environmentalists, I don't think ever.
Actually, no, not environmentalists. I'm just talking about rank and file.
That's true.
I mean,
I think when the smog
people.
Is gone and the rivers aren't burning, I think that there's less urgency around it. And really, that's what most politicians react to is that urgent situation right now, the financial crisis, the housing bubble, whatever it happens to be. And the environment, you know, sometimes and often actually takes a back seat to those sort of immediate needs. I think Earth Day is a great opportunity to kind of bring them to the fore and to say that there's actually a lot of environmental issues that we still need to work on. The issues aren't as glaring as they were in the 1970s when there was lead coming out the exhaust pipe of every car.
Mm-hmm.
Taking lead out of gasoline was a gigantic step in the right direction. So was going to ultra-low sulfur diesel, which has happened in the past few years here. That's taken a lot of air pollution out of the air, and that's really affecting local air quality, which – that's what most people notice is pollution.
But, you know,
very few people notice CO2 as pollution.
Well,
CO2 is colorless, odorless.
Right. That's right. I think that there was a good article today. I can't remember where I saw it, but it said that the environmental hazards of today are largely invisible. So they're not the flaming of, you know,
right, which can be a detriment to the quote unquote movement. You know, it's funny, too, when Tom, our last caller, brought up the issue of the gas shortage in the 70s, remember it well. It kicked in 2 weeks after I got my driver's license. I resented it bitterly. But it wasn't the environment that was driving people for those more fuel-efficient automobiles. It was finances. It was their pocketbook.
And that is an important issue that I think is driving people towards the idea of like energy security today, where a lot of people on kind of both sides of the political fence want – more of our energy to be produced domestically, just because so we're not held to, you know, foreign powers.
Point being, we can't depend on them for oil and we can't depend on ourselves for oil in the long term. So we have to look at alternative.
Yeah. And I think that it's smart of, you know, biofuels. Certainly they have a big knock against them. And I'm sure Cheryl will chime in about that. You know, but there's been a big push for biofuels for that reason that some of them have better life cycle environmental impacts. Some of them do not.
That's right.
But what they do have is that biofuels are produced close to where they're used. And that's been a big boon for everybody along the political spectrum.
And the easiest green thing that we could do as far as saving money is energy efficiency. I mean, it costs us very little to do it, and we get the best bang for our buck. We get reduced heating rates. We get reduced water heating bills. We get, you know, reduced air conditioning rates. It really, you know, is a fantastic way for us to cut energy costs, cut the expense to our families, tackle climate change. And, you know, just recently the EPA had a wonderful program where they were giving small incentives for you to upgrade your appliances, your energy appliances, and you could get a certificate.
Well, cash for junkers or whatever they call
it. Yeah, right. It was
cash for clunkers, right.
Cash for updating a refrigerator to an Energy Star refrigerator and cash for your washing machines. But, you know, we do still have to, you know, recognize that there are some schemes out there that, you know, maybe are washed in this green, you know, color that aren't the best things for our environment. And biofuels and biomass, you know, burning to generate electricity is certainly one of those, and something that Buckeye Forest Council is working on very heavily right now.
Let's take another call. 614-292-8513. Kathy wants to talk about turning solid waste into energy. Kathy, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I was just wondering if when I first turned on the radio, you guys were talking about solid waste and garbage. Mm-hmm. And there was an article a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times talking about, particularly in Europe, they have these clean energy burning garbage, gives off very little emissions, and they're using it for the power from there for electricity. And I was just wondering if that's anything, if you guys saw the article, if it's anything we're looking into doing here.
Hasn't it been tried?
Yeah, it's tried and it doesn't work. There's significant information that shows that dioxin is a toxic substance that is a carcinogen. It causes cancer, and it's given off by trash incineration. And again, this is a case where, you know, we're saying it's clean. You know, we're saying it's clean and green. You know, those are taglines that I think industry uses to gloss over some of the real concerns about burning trash.
Well, why are they using it in Europe?
I think it's Denmark, or I think it was in Denmark. This article highlighted they're getting a significant amount of their electricity from this, and the plants are not in poor neighborhoods. I mean, they're like up against these really well-to-do neighborhoods, mm-hmm. because there's no smell. There's nothing being given out. Well, it's a great article. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a big.
No, it's not. I actually have read the article, and I'm involved in a work group that is pushing back against that article, simply because there's not a significant amount of evidence that shows that new generation trash burning incinerators, and that's what they are. They're incinerators, in any way going to be a less of an impact on human health. Again, mm-hmm. I would point to the significant emission of dioxin that is released by trash burning incineration. And we had a huge blow up in this country in the 1970s around this issue, and is still something that should be thought about. And we don't know what's in trash landfills. I mean, trash contains, you know, contaminants like lead, like mercury, like cadmium. That, you know, there are many, many toxic substances that are in our trash, you know, especially when you start thinking about the computers that everybody is, you know, right. replacing hand over fist.
They are at Sweco, I know, and other places using the gases from decomposing
right.
trash.
And yeah, and that's a win-win situation for those landfills. You know, a landfill is going to generate methane and other gases, and if a landfill is able to capture that, they can reuse it for either on-site electricity generation, or they can sell it and somebody can take it off-site. But it also reduces the odors from a landfill as well. So, you know, we have a lot of landfills around the state that have odor issues, and if you're able to capture that gas, it's really an environmental win-win situation.
Kathy, thanks for your call. It was a good question. Good topic. Thank you.
Jed, weren't they given an award a few years ago by the EPA?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I think they were.
Sounds like the kind of thing that we would give them an award for. So.
It's much better program, I think, to capture that methane release, keep it out of the atmosphere, and use that for energy generation.
And reduce the solid waste in the beginning.
That's important. Segregating the waste is very important, too. There's a lot of value and there's a lot of energy that goes into the landfill every day. And some of it can be cleanly burned, actually, but some of it cannot be. Yeah. And if we didn't throw any electronics away in there, if we didn't put a lot of things into the landfill that shouldn't go there, if we didn't put glass bottles there, there's so many recycled streams that actually have value that if we separated them out at the source instead of throwing them all together at the landfill, where they get to be this kind of hodgepodge of things that are difficult mm-hmm. to incinerate. And then there's there's technologies beyond incineration too. I mean, certainly plasma torches and things like that that consume a lot of energy. So you don't get nearly as much energy out of it as you would in a traditional incinerator, but it burns at a high enough temperature that pretty much everything gets disassociated.
You know, one of the things that we haven't talked about in the context of landfills and waste generation is the importance of composting. Mm-hmm. You know, so much of what we throw away can be easily composted, applied to your yard or garden.
You know, that's some neighborhoods don't allow composting.
I guess I'd have to look at, you know, local zoning
laws. Well, because
of
the smell and the potential unsightliness, but I think the smell is more the problem for me.
Yeah, I mean,
it's the same places that don't allow a lot of stuff that.
Yeah, I mean, unless you live in a neighborhood that has some sort of local zoning ordinance against composting, it's something that is very easy for people to do. It's cheap. It saves you on fertilizers if you're fertilizing your garden, and it keeps a lot of organic waste out of the landfill.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of new innovative ideas on ways that you can have composting in your yard and have it be unsightly. There are a number of corporations that are developing tools. There's, you know, a bin that you simply open a little louver on the door. You put your kitchen waste in, you close the door, and then, you know, you spin it and it tumbles itself. And it's, you know, it's not, you know, what I have at my house, which is a fence, a picket fence that, you know, keeps it from being unsightly. But again, if you take a composting class or it's something that you're lucky enough to have a farmer in your area that can teach you about, there's no smell. If you're doing it properly, there really isn't a smell, and you really shouldn't have problems with rodents and that type of thing. So it can be a learning curve in order to learn how to do these things and keep them, you know, nice and unsightly.
It's important to keep it a vegetarian too. Yeah, it removes the vermin problem.
Right. We were, when we were getting off our plane a couple weeks ago when we returned from vacation, the Starbucks in the airport had a bin and of these big bags, and it said free. So I immediately, my antennae went up, and it was coffee grounds. Mm-hmm. So I grabbed the biggest, I didn't want to be a hog, but I grabbed the biggest bag I could find. I didn't grab all of them. And there was nobody there. It was late at night. I could have, but I didn't. Just dumped them in my garden. You know, just they said you can just dump that right in your garden. So there's some things like that they can just go right in.
They make great side dressing for plants, and they're great mulch. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, anything that you put about on your garden or around your plants can act as a mulch and keep the moisture in, then, you know, cut down on your water bill and add nutrients as well.
We're going to have to take another break, and then we'll get to those phone calls. We'll get to those emails. If you want to call it, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be back with a little more green music and All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I listen to NPR every day. It gives us insight into why people do what they do and have a passion for it. We hear from people in their words, and it's not the reporters telling us what this and that person said, whether it's about the economy in the United States or the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm Bethany Donnell, and WOSU is my source for in-depth reporting in a soundbite age.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear how artists and scientists are working together to call attention to climate change. That discussion begins at 11. Tune in tonight at 9 on WOSU TV for WOSU's special culinary event, Chefs in the City. Now in its fourth year, this year's gourmet food experience features PBS celebrity master chef Rick Bayless and several other local chefs who will share their cooking tips and tricks and prepare some mouthwatering recipes. Watch Chefs in the City tonight at 9 on WOSU TV. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 68. Clouds tonight and a low of 45. A little sun and a few clouds for Friday and a high of 63. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Oh, Mother Earth, with your fields of green, once more laid down by the hungry hand, how long can
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was Mother Earth, the Natural Anthem by Neil Young. Another oldie but goldie, I guess. We have some calls, 614-292-8513, and I'm glad that Jean held because Jean's a teacher. Hi, Jean.
I have to correct. I was a teacher.
You were. Well, I think once a teacher, always a teacher, but go on.
It's not terribly relevant to your conversation this morning, but I want to give you a little history. When I taught back in 1959 to 1963, one of the required units of fifth graders, and that's the grade I taught, was a conservation unit. And we studied animals and soil and all of those things. Unfortunately, we didn't know much about recycling and global warming and all those things then. But I think it might have been the precursor of more of Earth Day and that sort of thing. At that time, I believe Earth Day was called Arbor Day.
Well, there still is Arbor Day.
Yep.
Well, at that time, that's all we had.
Yeah,
and so we planted a tree. But one of the experiments we did was there was a sink in the hallway. So I put one of my students out there alternating throughout the day, and they collected the water when it had been left on. The kids didn't turn it off completely. And so we collected the water that was wasted by not not turning the sink off, and it was significant. Hmm. My regret is I don't believe that program evolved over the years into what would have been helpful for us, and maybe taught more kids the importance of our natural resources and taught them some of the things that would be helping us out now. I'd like to think that my fifth graders maybe will remember those good old days and those experiments and are better citizens as a result.
I'd be curious to know, Jean, whether you taught in a urban or a rural school system.
I taught
system.
In Columbus Public Schools.
Columbus Public Schools,
Chicago
okay.
Avenue on the west side.
Because I would have thought that back then that you might have had more conservation education in some of the more rural school districts where—
Like 4-H type stuff?
Yeah, 4-H type stuff where kids are growing up on a farm and you have more of a knowledge and awareness of, you know, water usage and land usage and so on. But that's interesting.
That's probably why we had it, because we fit, maybe the powers that be or were— thought that we weren't getting that kind of information because we were an urban school. But one of our field trips, we used to be able to have money to do those, was to Blacklick Woods, and there was a wonderful naturalist there who we just all loved. And I regret he has passed away, but it was altogether it was a wonderful experience. And so I know it doesn't relate too much to what you're talking about today, but just thought you'd like a little history.
We're talking about it all, Jean. Thanks for your call. It definitely relates.
Sure.
You know, we're talking about our relationship with our food and how so many of us have become very distant from the source of our food and, you know, where a tomato comes from. It's sort of like that with our environment, too. It's not surprising that each of you mentioned a personal relationship with the environment growing up. It wasn't something that was just, you know, your love of the environment didn't come about in an epiphany. It came about more gradually. And so many kids now they're starting – well, they've been doing it for a long time. Even back when I saw the documentary by WOSU about the Short North, they talked about how they back then took the kids from Flytown and brought them out to a camp somewhere out, you know, so that they could be exposed to nature.
Well, Camp Mary Orton has been doing that for
right. Just
– a century now, I think, that it's hard to believe that, I mean, there's all this rage now about leave no child inside and things like that. And they were thinking about it 100 years ago already. And that's really in their charter is about bringing urban children out to nature.
You know, I was wondering if what happened with Jean's situation after, you know, she didn't teach for about 4 or 5 years, but the environment became politicized.
I think it certainly has. And I think, you know, we all have memories of our childhood where we are out, you know, enjoying nature. And, you know, Republicans, the Republican movement were the first to have, you know, conservation-minded policy in this country. And I think that that's, you know, something that we forget, that, you know, the word conservative was the foundation of the word conservation, which is now associated with the environmental movement. So, you know, really it has become politicized in the last, you know, certainly over the last 15 to 20 years.
Let's take another call right now. Rich has responded to my request. So, Rich, you get to be on the air. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
You got interested in the movement in the 70s.
Yes, back in actually before, but was involved in the first Earth Day in the Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm.
And the key issue there, which is one that hasn't been brought up today, is population.
Yes.
And the human population issue is sort of at the root of most of the expanding impact that we're having. And I'm kind of, I guess, trying to bring that subject up and have people think about it. I mean, if just a little bit more effort was put into education and development in some of the developing countries, particularly for women.
Yeah, but you know that.
Girls,
well, we were just talking about the politics.
I'm not talking about. I'm trying to avoid.
I know you are, but I know you are,
But the issue in the third world is more desired family size. If you educate young girls, they develop a broader perspective of the world. They realize there's more to life than just marrying very early and having lots of kids. And they actually develop stronger families, but probably smaller families. It's been shown over and over that early education can change the trajectory of population growth.
Cheryl?
And with a smaller population growth, these countries can manage their environmental situations a lot more easily.
Cheryl, you want to talk about that?
Hi, Rich. Thanks for calling in. I think that, you know, what you're talking about is really the foundation of what we mentioned earlier today, which is sustainable development. And, you know, certainly as we move forward and looking at, you know, resource depletion across the world, part of that is going to be working with folks in other countries and other cultures that don't have the resources they need to survive. So the lack of access to resources. And one of those resources that, you know, they may not have access to is education. And there's, you know, a lot of those people that have lack of resource access also depend more on the resources in their general area. So I think that, you know, by looking at access to resource and education certainly being one of them, and women as a whole, women and girls as a whole, they're the majority of the population that don't have access to that. So I agree that this is definitely, you know, a topic that has been politicized. And I think that climate change really has brought that issue again to the forefront of us looking to, you know, trying to create a balance where we can make it possible for those that don't have access to resources to have more resources, because there are still a lot of folks across the world that are hungry and don't have an education. At the same time, you know, trying to battle the issue that we have here in this country, which is we seem to think that we have an abundance of resources and that we can use other resources in other countries to satisfy our needs. So it's going to be something that's difficult for us to address. So kind of reducing our consumption of resources while elevating folks in developing countries so that they can have more resources. So it's definitely a huge challenge for our future.
I think the key issue, I think, is living smarter rather than – it's not a deprivation thing. Nobody mm-hmm. should have to change their lifestyle for the poor or for worse. What actually happens, I think, if we're more efficient and live smarter, is we actually have a higher quality of life and have a more satisfying life with plenty of abundant resources. resources if we just use what we do use smarter. I mean, I think one of the issues that you brought up earlier about the burning trash in Europe issue, I'm not sure about that particular article, but I do know that in Denmark and in other European countries, they've had a much more efficient recycling stream. So it's conceivable that their levels of plastic and electronics in the trash that's actually burned in those plants is significantly lower than it would be here in the United States, where we're very poor at that. We recycle a fairly tiny fraction of our waste stream and do have a pretty badly contaminated waste stream with all components mixed together, whereas in Europe they often have, at least where I've lived for a while, in Australia and in Europe both, they have a very much more strongly controlled recycling stream that's freely available to everyone.
Yeah.
So all the plastics, all the glass, all the metal is separated, and the small amount of paper that's not directly recyclable plus garbage gets into the trash, but it's not nearly as contaminated as it is here in the U.S.
Hey, Rich, I want to give some other folks a chance.
Sure, I'm sorry.
But no, I could listen to you all day, so don't worry about that. But thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was in Australia, and you know, it's an island economy, and it's an island environment. And I was telling a taxi driver one time about how people just dump their ashtrays from their cars out in the, you know, at stop signs and stuff like that. And he actually had an intake of breath, like, you know, he was just so shocked by that. Let's take another call, Elizabeth. You've been waiting a long time, but we're running out of time. So, you want to talk about some legislation? Thanks for your call.
Thanks. I would be listening anyway, so that's fine. My son's high school class did the SWACO visit, and it was very, very instructive. And afterwards, he became very interested in the issue of, as you mentioned, styrofoam in the landfill and what a problem it is and how disproportionate a space it takes up. And he did a lot of research on the subject and put together a position paper and proposed legislation to reduce and restrict the use of expanded polystyrene in Ohio in packaging and in the food industry, food and beverage industry. And he actually has two legislators who are potentially interested in sponsoring it. And the EPA has been really helpful in reviewing his position paper and all that. So the one group we've had trouble raising some support from is the Ohio Environmental Council. I know they're not represented there today.
No, they can't defend themselves, but that's interesting, Elizabeth. Jed, you want to say something?
Well, it sounds like, first of all, kudos to you, Elizabeth, and your son for taking that on. That's an impressive amount of work. You know, I can't speak for the OEC. They're a great group. They have a lot of irons in the fire. They work on a lot of different pieces of legislation. I know at the State House, it could be that their plate is full and they simply don't have the time to work on it. My guess is they would probably be fully supportive of the piece of legislation. But best of luck to you and your son trying to get that ushered through.
Well, thanks. Senator Fred Strayhorn, a Democrat, and Representative Ross McGregor, a Republican, were the two who expressed interest.
Bipartisan support, very smart.
Bipartisan in both houses. So if anyone has connections to them and would like to throw a little more weight behind it, that would be really appreciated.
I would suggest that you try going another route, which would be writing letters to the editor and getting some smaller organizations on board with this instead of maybe going for the big guns. You can do a lot if you can bring together some smaller groups and you run an effective media campaign. Get the word out there in the newspaper and on the web and try to create some momentum. That's often the position that I find myself in is, you know, bringing together the smaller groups to create some momentum and get our issues put forward.
Oh, great. Okay. Thank you for that advice.
You're welcome. Thanks, Elizabeth. We had a caller. He had to hang up. We're sorry you had to hang up, Tim. I know you're out there somewhere. But he wanted to know about events going on for Earth Day. I know, Tad, that you had your big events last week.
No, it's still coming up
okay.
here. So,
and I wanted to put in thing. COSI is having an Earth Day celebration. You can go there today until 3:30. And, Tad, what do you
There's much more. So the event that we put on, that Green Columbus organizes in for the last 4 years, is a two-part event. We have a large-scale coordinated volunteer effort, and then we have a celebration. For the first couple years, that was all in one day.
You got to have a party.
Right.
Okay.
most cities only have a party. So a lot of cities look to Columbus and they're envious of our model where we do both a party and make a real difference by working in our communities. For this year, we kind of separated the two a little bit because it's the 40th anniversary. We wanted to have a bigger event. So this past Saturday and Sunday were for the volunteer activities. And then the celebration is today. It's at Franklin Park from 3 to 10 o'clock. And it's going to be a great event. We have two stages of entertainment and information. We have over 50 booths of environmental organizations and green businesses.
Where can people go to get more information?
They can go to our website, which is update2010.org, or just come down to the park. Okay. Come down to the park after school, after work today. There's going to be so much going on. The governor is going to come out and talk to us about 4:15, and then we're going to have some other featured speakers at 7:30 and award our Earth Day Challenge Cup, which goes to the school, the company, and the nonprofit that sent out the most volunteers to work at Earth Day work sites.
Okay, we'll post that website on our website, wosu.org/allsides. That always gets a smile out of my producer, Amy Jurevich, whenever I say that. And, you know, quickly, Cheryl, is there anything you guys are doing? Because I went to your website.
We are. We're actually collecting petitions today. We'll have a petition signatures. We'll have a booth at the Earth Day event, manned by volunteers, and also we're collecting signatures on a very disturbing effort to burn whole trees for power generation that's being incentivized by state and federal government. And so we really have a concern about that at Buckeye Forest Council. So we'll be collecting signatures to send to the Congress, actually, for this big campaign. And we'd hope everybody would come down, sign our petition, and join the fund this afternoon.
Jed, I've got about 20 seconds.
Well, every day is Earth Day at the
every
EPA.
Every day, okay. So. All righty. Well, we're running out of time. I'm sorry I couldn't get all the calls, and I'm sorry I couldn't get to all the emails. Maybe next time it sounds like we could continue this conversation because every day is Earth Day. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Sorry.